Alrighty, so jump right to it. Just by brief way of introduction, I'm Rabbi Stephen Gottlieb. I'm a member of Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, based out of Yeshivat Or Chaim. I'm also the rabbinic educator at the Village Shul, and it's really lovely to be able to give the Parsha Shir this week with Torah in Motion. Rabbi Kelman was very gracious to invite me to do this. I want to talk about something that might be a little strange. You know, if you get a knock on the door at your house, and you know, maybe it's someone who's trying to sell you a better deal on cable, if cable guys still do that, maybe you'll talk to them. Someone who's maybe trying to canvass for an election, maybe you'll talk about them. The one thing you never open the door for, or maybe my family was strange in this regard, but the one person you never open the door for is the person who is out there, Bible in hand, saying, "I want to talk to you about God." You know, people don't really have those conversations so often. And what I want to do tonight is, well, talk to you about God in a particular way. I want to try to address a question raised by this week's Parsha, by the recitation of the Aseret HaDibrot, of the Ten Commandments, Ten Utterances, however you want to translate that phrase, where the beginning phrase is a little hard to understand. The words are easy enough, we'll get to see. But the question is, what comes from that? What comes from the statement that Hashem is our God? What does it imply? Is there a command to believe? And if there is, what does it look like? And if it's not, why wouldn't there be one? And I want to be able to address that question from the lens of figuring out how it actually impacts our life. This isn't just going to be a philosophical, theological lecture, but I really want to try to get to the core of what it means for us to be ma'aminim, ubnei ma'aminim, what it means for us to be believers in Judaism in a significant way. And hopefully by the end of this, you know, roughly somewhere between 45 minutes to an hour shiur, we'll get to some kind of closure on that question. Now, as a disclaimer, what we are not going to be discussing is the conception of God that we believe in. I think that's a much larger question. There are many more answers to that question. So we're not going to be talking about how transcendent Hashem is. We're not going to talk about how personal he is. We're not going to talk about it within the broader context there. That's a separate question. It's an important question. Hopefully, it's a question that we've all spent time thinking about in at least some way. But right now, we are going to bracket that question. So, whatever conception of Hashem you are coming in to this shiur with can be kept, and we'll hopefully be able to get something out of this regardless. And so, with that in mind, I'm going to place the source sheets in the chat as a Google Drive link. Oh, one moment, I don't have it copied. One moment. Okay, I just placed the source packet in there. These sources are strictly to keep me honest. I'm not going to be quoting every single source inside. I am not going to be reading every single word from it. You can just have it open if you would like to make sure that what I say is matched by what's on it, and that I'm not just making things up as I go. So if you're the suspicious type, this is the shiur for you. And I want to open just with this this little meme that I put on the front, which I guess dates me in that it has a reference to the long forgotten MySpace. From what I hear, Facebook isn't even used either. One of my friends actually saw this on the source sheet, and he said, "I don't understand how you can only be 5 years older than me and yet somehow 60 years older than me at the same time." But here we are, and it's a kid asking, presumably his father, you know, if God is so powerful and he's supposed to be everywhere, why can't we find him on the internet? Why can't we see Hashem right in front of us? And I think we'll see that this is actually going to be one of the core questions that arise from this broader conversation about what it means to believe and what it means to potentially have to believe. Because if we don't have that, if we don't have something in front of us that we can see, how do we do that? How do we view that? With that question in mind, as well as this broader question, we can jump into discussing the sources, starting with the psukim from this week's parsha. So Parsha Vayechanan includes, amongst other things, a repetition of the Ten Commandments, which obviously include, and this is in the bold on the first source, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Sicha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. I am the Lord your God, who took you out from the land of Egypt. This is, by all accounts, a statement. It's immediately followed by something that's very easily considered a commandment. Don't worship other gods. That's an easy, you know, do-don't thing. But saying, I am the Lord your God, does not necessarily jump out at us as a command. As I said, it's a statement. It's a declaration. It's saying, here I am. Maybe it's calling for a response, you might argue. But it is not a direct command. It is not saying, believe in me. Now, you might argue, you know, Rabbi, why would we need to have a command? He's there. He's speaking. You know, a command is superfluous at that point. And maybe so. But at the same time, in order to be formally clarified as a mitzvah, formally classified, I should say, as a mitzvah, it's going to require something significant. So is this a base assumption, an experience perhaps, or is there something more to it significantly? So we'll find out. The Talmud, by the way, particularly in Maseches Makos here, where it's articulating how many mitzvos there are, does include it as a mitzvah. I'm not going to be going through this word for word, but basically we're trying to figure out how many mitzvahs are there in the Torah. It uses gematria based on the particular things. And at the end, it reaches the number 611. How do we get to 613? We add Anochi Hashem Elokecha as one, know that I'm the Lord your God, and don't have other gods to get to those last two commands. So the Gemara in Makos here takes for granted this idea that this is in fact a mitzvah. It is counted in the 613. And in fact, it is one of the ones that get us to that number of 613 that we take for granted. Elsewhere in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, this is source number 3, it's playing a little bit more fast and loose with the pasuk. It's saying, how do we know that that someone who has scorned Hashem is considered an idolater, is referring to an idolater. And it says it's because they've scorned the verse, Anochi Hashem Elokecha v'lo yeh lecha Elokim acherim. It's someone who's denied, I am the Lord your God and don't worship other gods. This makes it a little bit less clear because we're talking about someone who's an idol worshiper. So which part of this are they going against? Is it one statement or two? The entire pasuk is quoted here, as opposed to only that last part, which is a little bit more unclear, but we have at least one definitive voice that this is, in fact, a mitzvah, and here showing that it's at least part enough of the command not to worship other gods that it should be taken seriously. Where we see this unambiguously counted as a mitzvah, counted, in fact, as the very first mitzvah, is the Rambam. In the Sefer HaMitzvos, he says it very, very clear. The first mitzvah is that we are commanded to acquire knowledge of the nature of Hashem's existence, to know that there is a God, to understand there is an original cause in the universe, and that it's brought everything else into being. This is as clear of a statement this is a mitzvah as possible. And of course, the citation for this is this pasuk, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, know that I am the Lord your God. He also then brings in this Gemara and Makos that we saw above that counts it in the count of mitzvos. So the Rambam is saying completely unambiguously, yes, this is a mitzvah. This is the first mitzvah. It is the very opening of the Sefer HaMitzvos. It is important. And something that a friend of mine pointed out is that for the Rambam, this is actually a major idea of the commandment to know God. It's not to have belief. It's to know. For the Rambam, Hashem's existence is a philosophical fact, rationally provable, and anyone can achieve it. I'm seeing my chavrusa Nafti Diena nodding to this. We've been learning the guide for the perplexed together, where he gets into this a little bit. But this is for the Rambam a core idea. And for the Rambam, we have to constantly strive to really understand the metaphysics behind what Hashem is. You know, this is not a shiur where I'm going to go through the Rambam in conversation with Aristotelianism and Neo-Aristotelianism and Platonism and whatever else. If you'd like to have that conversation with me, we are welcome to at a later point. But for now, suffice it to say, the Rambam believes this is something we constantly strive to figure out, to articulate to ourselves and others what this underlying metaphysics is. And he doesn't only say this as a throwaway line in the Sefer HaMitzvos, but in fact comes to the very first halacha in the Mishnah Torah. And just as an aside, I see that there are people who are writing in the chat. Rabbi Kelman informed me to look at the chat after the shiur is done to have that as time for the question and answer. So I apologize in advance to those who are writing in the chat. I'm going to try to end with a 10-minute window or so that we can have questions, discussion, and go through the chat. So do feel free to keep writing in the chat. But this is the official disclaimer that I will not be looking at it until nearing the end of the shiur. So as I was saying, the Rambam brings this down as the very first halacha, as law, in the Mishnah Torah. This is source number 5 for those who want to follow along in the source sheets, but no pressure to one way or the other. But the Yesod HaYesodos, that which is the foundation of all foundations, V'amar HaChachmos, that which all wisdom relies on, stands on, is Leda Sheyesham Matzoi Rishon, knowing that there is a first cause, that there is a being that started everything, created everything from it, and is traceable to us. And that this being, to use philosophical terms, is a necessary being, a being that has to exist logically and philosophically, and that if it did not exist, nothing else would be able to exist. This is a rejection of an idea that we just have cause and effect and cause and effect and cause and effect going back infinitely. There's a wall that wall is a necessary being that must exist, which is Hashem, a necessary being that has a sense of direction for the world to go in, that started this entire process of creation, leading all the way to us, that first cause. And we need to know this. We need to understand this. He's using the term Leda. Yes, there is a conversation about what exact word is used in different translations from the Arabic for his Sefer Mitzvot in particular. But here the Hebrew is clear. We're talking about knowledge. What does that knowledge mean? What does the search look like? So he articulates that a little bit later on in the Mishnah Torah, where there's this narrative portion as the introduction to Hilchos Avodah Zarah. When he opens the part of the Mishnah Torah about the laws regarding idolatry, he opens with essentially an intellectual history of how idolatry happened, why it came into being. And as part of that, he mentions the rise of Avraham Avinu, the rise of Abraham, and how he deduced logically through first principles that there was a God. This is not necessarily a halacha, it's a narrative part that he has in the halachos, but it's important nonetheless. I'll just paraphrase from the English translation there, which is from Chabad.org, that Avraham was, from a young age, very thought-provoking person. He was constantly looking up at the sky, constantly thinking, wondering, how could it be that we have this planet that works exactly the way that it should? How is it that everything comes together? This, by the way, he's bringing down from the Midrash HaGadol. That'll be important for the tail end of the shiur when we look at a parallel midrash from Bereishit Rabbah. But for now, this is as articulated by the Rambam. But Avram is asking, how can it be that nothing caused this world to revolve? How can it be that nothing caused this universe to move? He's talking about Aristotelian spheres and motions of the cosmos. probably, though this translation makes it a little actually harder to understand, funny enough. And everyone around Avram was idol worshippers. And as I'm sure many of us know, if everyone around you is doing something, it's very hard to avoid at least some form of a lemming effect. You know, not to say that we're all lemmings, chas v'shalom, but when everyone in your immediate community is doing something, is using particular words, viewing things in a particular way, it's very hard to be the one person to break away from that. And it's even harder to do so when no one else has ever done it before. Avram was an innovator in this sense. Avram was the one who realized, using, you know, let's say, an Occam's razor X principle, that we can deduce that there's only one God, that there is one cause, and all these other gods, that literally everyone around me is worshiping, is treating as a given, are wrong. And what did he do with that knowledge? Well, we all know the story of the smashing of the idols, but also he appreciated the truth of the universe, and then he acted on it. He understood it must be Hashem, it must be HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there must be only one God that is a first cause. And he went out and got converts. He went out and convinced people of this. And it took him time. You know, he was 40 when he first left. But he was able to formulate responses to these other people, to debate them, and ultimately to give them tochacha, to give them rebuke, and to get them to change their minds, to engage in a dialogue. And this happened because he came to a realization that Hashem exists. That realization made a claim on him to act. Just keep that idea in mind. It'll come back. But for the Rambam, what we have here unabashedly is that there is a mitzvah to believe in Hashem. There is a formal command to believe in Hashem. It is, in fact, that which everything else relies on to know. And we need to know in such a way that we are able to actually answer questions about it and understand the fundamental principles behind why we believe, what it stands on, what we're supposed to do with it, and how we're supposed to act in response to that. So that's the Rambam. There is another view, though. The Bahag also wrote a Sefer HaMitzvos, the count of the 613 mitzvos. And interestingly enough, in his Sefer HaMitzvos, the mitzvah to believe in Hashem, of Anochi Hashem Elokecha, is not present. The Bahag did not write why it is that he did not put that in his count. What we do have is, as a commentary on the Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvos, we have the Ramban, who comments on it in defense of the Bahag. So speaking on the Bahag's behalf, we'll see in a little bit that the Ramban at Nachmanides' position is a little bit more, is a little bit less, I should say, it's a little bit more complicated than what we will be seeing, but let's take a look nonetheless. The Ramban says that, this is source number 7 for those who want to follow along, by the way, that he saw that the Bahag did not count the mitzvah of Anochi Hashem Elokecha within the 613, within the count for these mitzvos. And he says it appears from the opinion of the Bahag that the only laws he counted were those laws concerning the doing of an action or the refraining from doing of an action, a mitzvah aseh and a lo ta'aseh. Just because I saw it come up in the chat as it was posted, yes, creed not deed is very much where the Bahag is coming from here. The Rambam was acting in a philosophical school of thought where creed is important. It's necessary metaphysically. The Bahag is seemingly, according to the Ramban, counting mitzvot only based on action. That which you do, that which you refrain from doing, those are what classifies as mitzvot for the Bahag. And the Ramban goes on, though, to say that the belief in Hashem, emunah, is not an action. But not only is it not an action, but it is in fact that which everything else is reliant on. Belief in his existence, which he informed us through miracles, through nevuah, through prophecy, which he revealed to us, all of that fundamentally could not be counted because it is the prerequisite for everything else. It is what everything else relies on in order to do. It's its own topic. It's its own understanding. What it is not is a formal command. Why? Because without this fundamental emunah, no other commands are even commands. They don't have any weight at that point. Why are you doing commands? Why are you acting? Why are you following these deeds? To live and show the belief that is there, that is driving it. So as such, of course it wasn't counted as a formal mitzvah. And so that's the Ramban defending the Behag. As we said, though, the Ramban himself is a little bit more complicated than that. So the braid I just have, he does say, this is from his commentary from Shmos, the first time we see the Pasuk of Anochi Hashem Elokecha. So he says, Adibur Hazeh Mitzvah Aseh. He says that this is in fact a positive commandment. And then he goes on to say it also acts as the prerequisite for other commandments, because you need to accept the law before you can do all of that stuff. But it is in fact for the Ramban a command as well. But in defense of the Behag, he says that we have these two fundamental areas. We have the area of action, the area of belief, and we do not conflate them halachically. Whereas for the Rambam, for Maimonides, they are 100% part of it. Just as you have halachos for what you do, you also have halachos for how you should philosophically be framing the world and reality, and it counts. So those are the fundamental positions. Those are what I'll call the primary positions. And within them, we're going to look at a very interesting idea, mostly through the eyes of Rav Chasdai Preshkas, who is a famous philosopher. This is source number 9 and 10 in the source sheets now. And I'll be going through these once again outside, but do feel free to look at them and make sure they are saying what I am saying that they are saying. The Rav Chasdai Preshkas says that the belief of all, the basis of all faith is belief in the divinity of the Torah and belief in Hashem. It is this yesod ha-yesodos, as we saw in the Rambam. However, to command that belief, to have it as a formal mitzvah, is a contradiction, logically. Because if you're commanding to believe in the commander, then the commander is commanding to believe in the commander, and you have an endless circle, an endless loop, you know, nothing makes sense. How do we have this chicken and egg, all of that? And as a result, it just doesn't logically make sense. So he infers from the existence of this contradiction that, you know, there just can't be a formal command, of belief. It doesn't make sense. It's an endless circle. So how can it possibly be? He brings down also in the second paragraph there a secondary argument, which is that when you talk about a command, when you talk about a belief, when you talk about a mitzvah, what are you talking about at the most fundamental level? It's not something you have control over. You have choice. Something that bechira applies to, ratzon and bechira, your will and your active choice. However, he points out, and this philosophically I think is a very important statement, that beliefs don't work that way. Beliefs aren't necessarily a matter of choice. You can't just choose to believe something. Once you know something enough to really live your life based on that, you know it. And it's going to be very hard to unknow that. You know, I cannot choose that 2 plus 2 equals 6. It doesn't work that way. And once you believe or understand that there is a first cause that is logically consistent, that is there, that started the world, that started the universe, started the cosmos, you know, you can't just unknow that. It would be very, very, very difficult, if not completely impossible. When you know it, you know it. So there can't be a mitzvah to believe, because you're not choosing actively to believe. You know, maybe there can be a mitzvah to reach that belief, and we'll see he says something similar. But there cannot fundamentally be a command that says, you need to believe in me, and then you do it, because it just doesn't work that way. It's not how human beliefs work. It's not how philosophy works. It's not how common sense works. So he gives two reasons here why it makes no logical sense for there to be a formal mitzvah. Reason number one that we saw was that it's complete circular logic, which is a logical contradiction. Reason number two being that beliefs aren't in the realm of ratzon and mechira. Beliefs aren't a matter of choice in the same way that my choosing to abstain from eating a cheeseburger or choosing to daven 3 times a day is a choice. It's not something you're actively choosing to do. It's there in the background at all times. But where do we go? How can it possibly be then that we are able to have an idea of schar v'onesh for this, an idea of reward and punishment when it comes to belief in God? How can that be? So he says something very interestingly in the next source. He says that we get reward for the joy, the happiness, the satisfaction that we achieve from getting to that belief, and that we are punished for not making it, not for not making it there necessarily, but we are punished for not doing our part to get there. We do not have the choice in where the dominoes ultimately fall, but we do have a choice in getting there for ourselves. Are we actually making the effort to understand what it means to say that there's a God, to understand how that could be? And that's where you get a reward. It's not a formal mitzvah in that way. The mitzvah there is for the quest, not the journey. It's very different categorically from what we normally think of as mitzvot, these ideas of doing particular actions or refraining from particular actions. But nonetheless, it falls within the realm of reward and punishment, because we are still expected to and responsible for reaching a particular place, a particular conclusion, and doing our part to get there. So that's how we're able to do that. And it's incredibly important. I just want to reflect on that for a moment. It's incredibly important to understand what this means in regards to the conversation we had broader. Whether it's a mitzvah or not, formally, there is a formal expectation, nonetheless. That expectation is either the yesod ha-yesodos, that which everything else is completely standing on and a part of the structure, or it is that structure. And without it, the entire thing falls apart. What this does not mean is that it does not say that we can just, you know, go on and ignore the question. It means we have to engage the question. We have to understand what it means to be believers and how to believe. And yes, you're going to run into this the circular logic, but you still have a responsibility to get there, to search, and with the expectation of reaching that conclusion. It's incredibly, incredibly important and incredibly valuable as well. Which brings to the question, well, how do we do that? How do we go about this search? How do we align ourselves with the direction that we are meant to go? How do we move ourselves in the direction we are meant to go? And how do we achieve what we are meant to as ma'aminim, as believers? So that's the question I want to try to devote the rest of this shiur to for the next 20 minutes, half hour that we have. And I want to start by looking at a very famous tshuva by Rav Elchanan Wasserman. Rav Elchanan Wasserman wrote this, it's called the Ma'amar al Ha'emunah. It's in his Kovetz Ma'amarim. And he wrote this as essentially a letter trying to understand what it means to believe in God in this world. This is a very abridged version. And he says that people who are immersed in temptations of this world, the taivos v'alam hazeh, are people who are going to be blinded from this question. He's making this into something a little bit more practical, and something that was brought up actually earlier this morning to me by a colleague, is that this tshuva fails to address what we see nowadays, the phenomenon of people who are completely orthoprax, but do not believe in Hashem. This fails to foresee that there can be people who are like that, which there most certainly are people who are like that. This is talking strictly about people who are no longer observant publicly, practically on that level. But so he says that there are some people who are blinded by desires, and as such, they're not going to be looking for answers to this question. And says regarding any manner that a person has been bribed, you're not going to see objectively. You're not going to see true. You want to do certain things. You want to live a certain lifestyle. You know, humans are at our core experientialist beings. We want to experience a certain type of thing. That is going to determine how we look at the world often. You know, we like to think that we have our thoughts all put together and act based on that. That is, in fact, things that some people do. However, the vast majority of human beings are living an experience first and then forming their beliefs as a result of the experience that they choose to have. And so he says, therefore, there's no surprise whatsoever that there are philosophers who reject certain things, because, you know, living in the world as if there's no God is an incredible bribe. It's incredibly tempting to say there's nothing watching me, to say that there's nothing compelling me to act in a particular way, to say there's no objective morality, all of the things that come from this sort of thing. To those who would question, can you have an objective morality without the existence of God? That is a separate shir. Is an important question. But all these things are what Rav Elchanan are taking for granted. And the way he understands it is that nothing is going to convince someone who's already chosen to live a life that is outside of the realm of Torah and mitzvos, that Torah is divine, that Hashem exists, and that these things are linked. However, and this is the, I think, upshot of his entire tshuva here, is that in matters of faith and knowledge, emunos videos, one can only know the truth once they free themselves from the temptations of this world. If you say, I'm going to push away the experiential, and I'm going to construct something on the basis of first principles, I'm going to really ask myself the question of how it can be that this cosmos could have started, and what makes sense philosophically, scientifically, all of that. You look at it outside the temptations in as unbiased of a way as possible. And people like that, who are hard to come by, he says, but that's how you do it. And he says most people aren't able to. You know, most people are not at that level where they can look at something completely without bias. So he says, so that's where Emunat Chachamim comes. That's where we have trust in our tradition. We have trust in our Rabbanim. who are capable of discussing these matters because they have essentially Das Torah. They have a close connection with this. And then you put it in conversation with Torah, and he says, just closing this out, without engagement in Torah, it is impossible for a person to free himself from that evil inclination, which twists. So Rav Elchanan is making two arguments simultaneously. He's making a, what I'll call, underlying argument, a rationalist argument, that if you are able to look objectively, you will come to the proper conclusion. The Rambam takes for that for granted as well. But he's also making a practical argument, that in absence of being able to do that, we have a tradition that knows more than us. And once we're engaged in a lifestyle of Torah and mitzvos, once we're engaged in it, once we're living and breathing it experientially, so that will help us automatically fight against our yetzer hara, fight against our temptations, live a life that is well planned, methodical, disciplined, and through that we'll be seeing clearer anyway, and be able to reach more of a conclusion. This is the same reason that oftentimes many monks will live very disciplined lives. It's the reason that you see oftentimes even atheistic philosophers will live life in a methodical way, because they're trying to tap into some kind of objective first principles that you can only really do through a life that's able to tell you no to base desires, a life that isn't entirely ran by the wants and needs of your yetzer hara, to bring it back into Jewish terms. When you have that, you're good to go. So we have, once again, this war between two perspectives. We can call the philosophical perspective and the experiential perspective, or maybe the thought and the action. Are we meant to cognize first and then live our lives based on that? Or are we meant to live and experience something and have our beliefs within that context, feeding into it in a sort of loop that's self-powering? Which way are we supposed to go? Which way is the ideal? And this is where I want to bring us back to that midrash that we saw quoted from the Rambam in the originally in the Midrash HaGadol, but quoted by him in the Mishneh Torah. The midrash that Avraham looked around the world and said, how could it be that such a meticulously created space cannot have a creator? That was a rationalist approach. He sat down, maybe laid down, looked up at the stars and said, how could it be that this universe does not have something that created it? How could it be that there's no watchmaker for this watch, if you will, and isn't still there and tweaking it, as opposed to what we call a classical watchmaker theory, where he doesn't. You know, this needs to be something that's maintained. It needs to be something that was created for a purpose. It's a very philosophical approach. There is, however, a second midrash, which I hinted to way back in the beginning of this year, a midrash in Bereishit Rabbah. This midrash is incredibly, incredibly important, because on the surface it tells a similar story, but we'll see that there's endless depth in this midrash. It's actually one of my favorite pieces of rabbinic literature. So this is on Lech Lecha, where Avraham Avinu is going, and it's compared to someone who's walking from place to place. And I just ignore the translation for now. It's spoilers if you're looking at the source sheet. But Avraham is walking from place to place. V'ra bira achat doleket. And he saw a palace, probably. We saw a complex that is lit up, doleket. And he says, how can it be that this complex, this palace, does not have anyone taking care of it? And suddenly what happens? Suddenly, the person who takes care of this place appears before him and says, I am the one who am taking care of this place. And he says that this is exactly what happened for Avraham. Avraham saw the world and said, how could it be that this world does not have someone who maintains it? Does not have a manhig, someone who's there, who's actively engaged with it. And only then, only after asking that question, Hashem exists and says, I am the owner, I am the creator of this world. He uses the term Baal, he is the master of this world. Now, many thinkers point out there are two ways of reading this midrash. I saw it beautifully articulated by Rabbi Jonathan Sachs in, I want to say Letter in the Scroll, but I might be misremembering which of his books it is. Ah, yes, exactly. So these two midrashim are seen in the beginning of his book. Thank you, Zahav. Yes. And there are two ways of translating this midrash, famously. So Bira Achat Doleket, a palace lit up. So Doleket can mean two different things, particularly in rabbinic Hebrew, where it's much less clear. So one is lit up, as in the lights are on. You know, the torches are lit. There's clearly, you know, it's fully functioning. Someone is here. Someone is taking care of it. So when you look at it that way, you have the logical presupposition. If you see a house with the light on the streets, there's probably someone there taking care of the house. You know, this is the common strategy that I'm sure many of us are guilty of when we leave our house for a few days and we don't want someone who's checking in on it. So you leave a light on and potential burglars will assume, oh, someone must be in there. So you see this palace that's perfectly functioning and you say, how can it be that there's not someone taking care of it? And lo and behold, there is someone who's taking care of it. So that's the first approach to this midrash. The second approach changes the story completely. The second approach is to translate Doleket as a blaze, on fire, lit up in the worst sense, being devoured by fire. Now, what's interesting is that when we have that in light of this midrash, there are interesting compare contrasts to have with the burning bush. That is not what we're going to talk about now, but it's interesting imagery, definitely some thought homework if anyone's interested. But without getting into that, we have this idea that instead of seeing a perfectly functioning house, a perfectly functioning world, and logically deducing that there must have been someone who set it up, we have a very different scene that plays out for us. We have a scene of going, seeing something on fire, in the process of being destroyed, being eaten up. And he says, how can it be that there's no one here taking care of this? And then what happens? Hashem appears and says, I'm the one taking care of it. That even if it's a blaze, even if it's wrong, even if it doesn't seem right to us, Hashem is there. And in fact, some philosophers, Jewish and non-Jewish, would argue that the fact that you can articulate that something is not, quote unquote, what it should be, implies that there is a should out there that you intuitively know. So Avram seeing the world in all of its complexity, in all of its uncertainty, a world full of torment, full of doubt, nonetheless, he experiences an emotional, intuitive tug. How could it be that there's no one taking care of it? And then upon understanding that there is something to strive for still, that there's something that it should be, then and only then does Hashem appear before him and say, I am the one who is the master of this world. It's a very different approach. Again, melding these ideas of the rational and the experiential. But in this case, showing that they're inseparable and showing that, in fact, I might have been either accidentally or on purpose leading us on a wild goose chase. Because in fact, the two are two sides of the same coin. We have rational approaches. We need to have them. We need to understand why we think what we do. But divorced from our emotions, divorced from our experience, it's just numbers in a code. It needs someone to actually input it to actually live it, to actually experience it with all of our being, with our bodies, minds, and souls, then and only then are we able to achieve this. And I think that this brings to a powerful idea, the idea that we need to take our full selves into account. We need to understand that sometimes there will be times of doubt where we fall short from this idea to know completely and utterly, but that we can still strive to get there, and that there is a there to reach. We know that intuitively. We know that logically. The question is how to get there. So there's a beautiful piece by Rav Shagar here that I wanted to include. Source number 13, for those who are looking, the English is from the official English translation of the piece that Koren published. And he talks about Avraham once again, this time in light of the Akedah. And he quotes a powerful midrash. And he quotes a midrash that the Satan appears to Avraham and tells him, Avraham, it wasn't God, it wasn't Hashem who told you to go sacrifice your son. It was me. And when you go and you do that, it's going to be me getting what I want, not God getting what he wants. And according to the Midrash, that actually did make Avraham doubt. But he said, even so, you know, I don't know what you're telling me, but I do know that I experienced Hashem telling me to do this. And even so, I'm going to go through nonetheless with what's expected. And this is what he does, but importantly, what Rav Shagar points out is that this is not obedience motivated only by submission. This is turning it into an active choice. He says, just to quote this bolded part at the very end, if you want to read along, you do not have to. He says, in any event, it appears as though Abraham's insistence on the divine origin of the imperative can be facilitated only by that seed of doubt. In other words, he needed that doubt to be there so he could transcend that doubt. This is what sets it apart from an ordinary obedience, especially if you read it as a manifestation of his own misgivings. The Satan, not literally, but as a manifestation of Avraham's internal psychology. He says, in transience that does not take doubt into account is meaningless and false. When we look at the world, we need to look at the world as our full self. Taking into account everything, but understanding that we know there is something to strive for, A, and B, that is something that we can strive for, that we can actually reach. It's within our grasp. We have ways of realizing it. Avraham internally had to think, and he really had to make sure that this was coming from Hashem and not from the Satan. The Hasidim call this a process of birur, of really clarifying that it wasn't. It wasn't just Abraham saying, oh, I don't believe you, Satan. It was taking time and effort to very seriously think about what it means to do this and how he knew it was a divine command. And then and only then to say, I acknowledge that I have doubts. I acknowledge I didn't get there yet all the way. But I know enough. I know where I'm striving for. And I'm not going to stop that journey just because of some doubts. I'm going to continue climbing this mountain, literally, as my full self, belief, doubt, knowledge, and everything in between. This is how I am going to lead my life. The way that psychologists often explain this in the realm of behavioral psychology is that the world is made up of three realms. You have the realm of the known, what we know for sure and take for granted. You have the realm of the unknown, the complete mystery, the expanse. We haven't even gotten there yet. We don't know what to do. It scares us. And in the middle, you have the lens by which you view the world such that you can navigate that divide. You have the meaning by which you have a map to navigate with. And when you use that map that we have, it gives us a battle plan. It gives us a destination. It gives us something we do. This is what I want to argue, a core in being a Jew. So much so that for the Ashkenazim in the room, the Rama thought it was important enough to include in his very first comment on the Shulchan Aruch, the final source in the packet, source number 14, the Rama says, commenting on the very first halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, Shivisi Hashem l'negdi samid, have Hashem in front of you at all times, hu klal gadol b'Torah. That is one of the most important principles of the Torah. Why is that? He goes on to say, because the way that we sit, the way we move, the way we deal with other people are very different when we're alone compared to when we know we're being watched and compared to when we know we're in the presence of a great king. You know, maybe the prime minister is a bad example. I don't know enough about Canadian politics to say one way or the other. But when you're in the room with someone you respect, you will act very, very differently than if you are alone. We live better lives, not only practically, but psychologically as well, when we are within this framework. But in order to get into that framework, in order to have Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Samid, we need to have a concept of Hashem to put there. We need to know what it is that we're engaging ourselves with. So we have both sides of the coin. The rationality, the knowledge, the knowing leads us to action. They're part and parcel. But the action is also how we make good on that belief, how we show that it actually matters, how we show that it's important. It's how we live our lives to the fullest. Now, does that necessarily require particular beliefs? You can say maybe you're just living within this a symbolic framework, a narrative framework. You know, some people try to argue that. Maybe, maybe not. But what we have is a clear approach here, shared by Maimonides and Nachmanides and even perhaps the Behag, that these two cannot be easily separated. That even if we don't have a formal mitzvah, a formal command to believe, belief is implied by what we do. We don't only think our beliefs, we live them. And when we do anything as a Jew, we should perhaps remember that we are not only doing it as us as individuals, but we are doing it to live out our responsibility in the world and our belief that nothing is random. Our belief that this world has a purpose and that we have a purpose within it. And when we do that, and most importantly, when we know that, then we're able to live lives to the fullest, to do our part, to bring our people together, to bring this world one step closer to the coming of Mashiach, b'mehirah b'yameinu. So on that note, I do notice there are many, many comments here in the chat, so we can go through them. If anyone has any questions, comments, concerns, you are more than welcome to unmute and raise them or to raise your hand. I don't know how Rabbi Kelman usually does this. You can do what you're used to, and I will facilitate to the best of my ability. So I'm just looking through these questions now. Instead of saying you shall have no other gods, which seems to imply that there are no other gods, why not just say other false gods? Oh, which seems to imply that there are other gods. That's an interesting question. And so scholars of Jewish studies will talk about a distinction between between monolatry and monotheism. Monotheism being the belief in only one god, and monolatry being a belief in several gods, but one over the others. Some will try to argue that things evolved such that there were belief in other gods first, and then it only later evolved into a true monotheism. But I think even with the wording as it currently is, you shall have no other gods, if we look at that as the practical part of the command. So you say, know that I am the Lord your God, that I am the only God that exists, and don't worship other gods. Don't act in service of any other deity, real or fake. I think that's one way to see that question. Then there was another question here. What does the Bahag do with the Bavli Makos? It seems to count the two mitzvos. It's an excellent question. I'm actually not entirely certain of that. This is another one in direct messages. Haven't many / most modern scholars argued or claimed that for the Rambam, proper understanding of God, even without doing any mitzvot, you get Olam Haba, but with an improper understanding of God, you do not. So that is easily a shiur in and of itself. The short answer is that yes, many do argue that. Many Jewish philosophers argue that as well, with no formal academic training, but who are just scholars of Rambam, seem to argue that that's an implication. That for the Rambam, having a proper belief is necessary to enter Olam Haba. So that is certainly an idea within scholars. What is the authoritative one? I do not know. I do not have a PhD, so I can't speak to who is really understanding that best. But certainly there is a school of thought there within the Rambam. There's another question here about cognitive dissonance, but it's a little off the topic. If anyone has any questions you want to ask, by the way, it's not just me reading through these and responding to them, you are welcome to. I really don't know how it's usually done with the Shiorim. I wasn't able to hear from Rabbi Kelman beforehand. So Gershon Hepner asked, is the mitzvah to know that there is a God comparable to the mitzvah to know our multiplication tables, not believing that 2 + 2 make 4, but knowing it? Yeah, so that's, I think, basically what the Rambam is getting at. You need to actually know that God exists. And it is, in fact, a philosophical fact. For the Rambam, even for most Aristotelian philosophers in his day and age, the idea of a necessary being was taken for granted as a fact. You know, it wasn't something you could easily not believe in. There had to have been something that was there. And for the Rambam, us reaching that conclusion, that certainty, is incredibly important. I think that's fundamentally what the mitzvah is for him. Is that an argument for religion in the case of Judaism, or a reaction against what might be viewed as society's faults? I don't quite know where in the shir that was referring to, for which argument that was. And so I just don't think I can answer that question fairly because I don't remember what it was referring to exactly. There are a lot of questions here. Is Pirat Delek an explanation for the burning bush? I believe it can be. And Nathan, that was the response of Rabbi Wasserman, this idea that you can achieve that and you are able to. Okay, on that note, it is just about 9:30 now. Thank you all so much for coming. I apologize that Rabbi Kelman wasn't here to better moderate. I'm sure I did not do as good of a job as he normally does, but Bezrus Hashem, next week he will be back. Thank you all so much for coming to this year. I hope that it was informative and enjoyable. Have a wonderful night and a wonderful and meaningful Shabbat.
Shalom and thank you.
Of course. If anyone does have any questions or comments, you can feel free to raise them.
Thank you.
My pleasure.